This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Many of us are still trying to make some kind of sense out of the shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. Perhaps that's impossible. But in the days after the shooting, people swarmed into the town to try and help.
This event, like 9/11, they were traumatic events in that they were both extreme attacks on our imagination.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from a Red Cross volunteer who went to Newtown the day after the shootings. Then we'll visit a California prison where inmates are doing their best to steer kids from their crime-ridden hometown towards education and a better life. We'll also get a quick update on what's turning out to be a very nasty flu season and spend an academic minute finding out that epidemics are all about the math. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. James Halpern went to Newtown, Connecticut the day after the Sandy Hook Elementary School shootings. He went for 1 week as a volunteer with a chapter of the American Red Cross from the Mid-Hudson Valley of New York State to provide counseling to immediate family members of the victims, as well as to other community members. The Best of Our Knowledge's Allison Dunn spoke with Halpern upon his return.
James Halpern has been with the American Red Cross since 1999, and he points out, disaster mental health really did not become full-fledged until the 1990s. Halpern's work with the Red Cross is in addition to, and sometimes part of, his work at the State University of New York at New Paltz's Institute of Disaster Mental Health, where he is the director. Halpern provides disaster grief counseling around the world. In the U.S., he provided assistance after the 2007 nor'easter, the Pennsylvania floods of 2004, and after 9/11. Among many other tragedies and disasters. When asked what was different about counseling right after the Newtown tragedy, he says,
"Well, here there were children that were involved. Here there were deaths that occurred so off course. And again, that was so shocking. And the families that I worked with, there were children, there were siblings, there were other children. So parents needed to get some information on what to do with their other children, whether those children should see caskets or attend funerals. How should they be treated? Is it okay for them to see their parents grieve and cry?" And I felt as though these were some of the kinds of conversations that I had with them that I thought were useful.
Former Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, who continues to recover from having been shot in the head during a mass shooting in her state 2 years ago, visited Newtown with her husband. She met with Connecticut officials and also with victims' family members. Halpern says given what he witnessed when President Obama came to Newtown, Giffords' visit was likely helpful for family members.
You know, the experience that I had when I was there being with immediate family members when Obama entered the room and supplied comfort, you know, I would suspect that it would be helpful. I think that there's a way that there are people who symbolize something bigger than the person. So, you know, Barack Obama, when he came into the room, was certainly an extraordinary person, but he also represented the nation as he embraced all those families. And it seemed to me to be very supportive and very helpful as he held those mothers and fathers. I would suspect that, you know, somebody like Gabrielle Giffords, who has shown extraordinary resilience, again, is a person, but then also symbolizes that sort of resilience, that ability to live with loss or to cope with some extreme circumstances.
What was the most striking aspect for you?
You know, this event, like 9/11, were particularly traumatic events for somewhat different reasons, but they were traumatic events in that they were both extreme attacks on our imagination. My view of trauma is that a traumatic event shatters our assumptions about ourselves, about other people, about the world. And although those events are different, they were similar in that I think I and a whole lot of Americans felt that it was so shocking and so outside the norm, and we were so deeply impacted by that. And certainly being in the community and trying to offer some support to these people who were unconsolable was striking.
There was so much media attention descending upon a town that normally doesn't have it, and it went on for days and days and days. What was helpful about all the attention and what was not?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I mean, I think that, you know, when there is a traumatic event like this, the idea that there is acknowledgement and recognition that something horrific has happened, that there is not indifference. I think people suffer enormously when there's indifference to tragedy. So all of that attention and all that media made very clear that the world cared. That was the good side. The not so good side is that people who were so confused and so lost and grieving were being contacted by celebrities, big name anchors, and were not sure. I mean, it added another layer of confusion and surrealism. And in fact, that's one of the, what I thought, helpful ways in which I counseled family members, that they didn't need to talk to these celebrities, that they could consider what, if anything, they could gain, what would be helpful for them about doing an interview.
What image or anything from your week in Newtown, Connecticut, perhaps plays over in your mind, or really you just envision a little more often than you thought you would?
There was that Sunday night prayer vigil, where that was an interfaith prayer vigil, and clergy from every faith embraced each other as they went to the podium and delivered some sort of comfort to those families. And when the president offered his speech and read off those names, and people held each other, you had an opportunity, I think, to see what we often see in these events. People responding with the best after the worst has happened.
Many people still want to help. Newtown has no shortage of teddy bears or baked goods. Yet Halpern has an idea of how best to help, and it's staying local.
I think the idea of maybe getting some training so that we can be a part of the response when these disasters occur in our own community, so that we can get some sense of control or power. And by learning how to be volunteers, whether it's volunteer firefighter or a volunteer for the Red Cross or other organization, is a way of helping our own communities.
Do you feel you fared okay personally?
I do, because I think what would have been more difficult had I not felt useful. And some of the families that I worked with made very clear that some of the counseling and some of the work that we did was helpful. And in that way, you know, it's an honor and a privilege to help someone at what could be the most important time in their lives. And that's, I think, why many of us do this work.
James Halpern is a psychology professor at SUNY New Paltz and the director of the Institute of Disaster Mental Health. I'm Allison Dunn.
With one of the highest crime rates in the country, Richmond, California is a regular on the evening news. Zoom out to just California and that crime rate looks even higher. The city's murder rate is 7 times that of neighboring San Francisco and more than twice as high as Oakland's. Only 9 miles west of Richmond is San Quentin State Prison. A lot of the men housed there are from Richmond and will return when they're done serving time. But that could be 20, even 40 years out. That's a lot of time to think about mistakes and leaves many inmates stuck in a place of depression, helplessness, and guilt. One group of Richmond inmates, though, have been transforming those feelings into something positive. Nicole James reports.
Past the barbed wire chain link fence and thick jail gates, go through the enclosed quad, and there it is, the San Quentin Prison Chapel. It's a place where a lot of the inmates meet for different groups, classes, and treatment programs. For most, their work ends at the prison walls. Not this group, though.
We want to help bridge that gap between the perpetrators, as you will, and the community.
Nate Collins is an inmate and president of the Richmond Project. It's a San Quentin-based group that works to improve conditions in Richmond from behind prison walls. Collins has been in prison since 2002, serving 60 years to life for second-degree murder.
You know, I've taken so much from Richmond. I've taken a life, and so, you know, this is my way of at least trying to give back. I won't be able to, you know, give back that life, but maybe I can stop, you know, someone else from taking a life.
Some of the men sitting in this room come from warring Richmond gangs. In the past, they couldn't be on the same street, never mind the same room. But these days, they're more likely to be talking about grant writing and fundraising for elementary school uniforms.
We want your freedom, right? But, you know, I just try not to focus on that. I just try to involve myself in whatever I can involve myself in to know that no matter my outcome, whether I go home or not, at least I know that I'm useful. I'm not just thrown away. I can actually affect change somehow.
One thing they're doing to affect change is running an essay contest for students at Richmond's Leadership Public High School. For the past 2 years, inmates have chosen topics for students to write about. It's a way for them to connect with the students and help find solutions to violence. They even organized cash prizes for the winners using the proceeds from snack sales in San Quentin.
I chose the one that, what would you do to help out someone?
Louis Ledesma, a 10th grader, won first place last year. He wanted to write about solutions to the violence in Richmond.
The shootings in this city have happened on a daily basis, and it makes most mothers terrified that their sons or daughters might get killed. In conclusion, I want to help the youth in Richmond because I am part of it. I know how difficult it is to be raised in Richmond, and we need a place like this to keep us away from violence.
Leadership Public High School's principal, Jesse Madway, says participating in the contest was an easy yes, even after he realized that convicted criminals would read and judge the students' essays.
You know, we don't spend a whole lot of time, I think, speaking about what happens to the people in this community who make the decisions that end people up in a place like San Quentin. You know, we certainly have a lot of families who have, you know, where, you know, brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles have run into trouble in their life and have, you know, made decisions that have gotten them into places like this, like San Quentin.
That said, the students aren't allowed to have any direct contact with the prisoners. In his office, Madway tells Luis Ledesma that working with them is still a powerful experience.
I'm sure that it just feels incredible to them that they're connected to you writing this. And probably for, you know, some guys who haven't been attached to a whole lot of positive things in their life, to feel like they generated the idea for you to write about must have made them feel pretty good the night that they went to bed after reading your essay.
Back at San Quentin, Nate Collins is staying busy with college-level classes and other groups. He says he especially appreciates the Richmond Project's curriculum. Nearly everyone who's participated has managed to stay out of prison after their release. Collins thinks that could be because they talk about things like PTSD, community justice, relationships, and peer pressure. Things he wants young men like Ledesma to start thinking about now.
These are the same things that we recognize that we were going through then. We just didn't know the words for it. We didn't know what it was. It took, you know, unfortunately for us to come to prison and then to be fortunate enough to come to San Quentin and be a part of a lot of the groups here to start to put names and words to some of the feelings and things that we were going through.
The men know they're somewhat unlikely mentors. Like Collins, most of them will be incarcerated for decades to come, so they can't do this work alone. Since the group started in 2006, Richmond City Council members and the chief of police have joined their meetings to help them accomplish their goals. The men are currently working with a pro bono lawyer to become a fully operating nonprofit. And in the meantime, they're already planning next year's essay contest. In San Quentin, I'm Nicole Jones for Cross Currents.
Still to come, nothing keeps more students home from school than a bad case of the flu, and we're in the middle of one of the toughest flu seasons in decades. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for the best of our knowledge, number 1166. This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Remember how mild last winter was? Well, the same thing happened with last year's flu season. According to the CDC, the 2011-2012 flu season set a new record for the lowest and shortest peak of influenza-like illness. The season began late, and the strain of flu was mild compared to most previous seasons. This year is so not like that. The season started early, and from last September through the end of the year, over 22,000 cases were reported nationwide. That compares to just 849 the year before. Plus, this year's strain of flu, the H3N2, is particularly nasty. Here to talk about this year's flu season is Dr. Gregory Poland, a professor of medicine and infectious diseases at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He's also the director of the Mayo Clinic's Vaccine Research Group. Doctor, this flu season began early and is still spreading. What's the latest estimate on how bad things are and when it'll peak?
Great question. No one really knows when it'll peak. As you know, it has kind of gone from the East Coast and the Southeast and Southwest now all the way to the West Coast. Virtually every state is experiencing widespread activity. And the problem is that it is a strain known to cause a lot of morbidity and mortality, and that's the H3N2 strain. Here in Minnesota, we've had more than a quadrupling of the number of deaths just in the last week or two. And that's a story that will be repeated in every state. It's very surprising to me that every year we seemingly have to re-educate the entire population on the seriousness of flu. And you hear it in the phraseology that's used. People will say, quote, it's just the flu. And that signals to you that they still think of this as a minor illness. And I've often said, what if this interview was back in October, and I said to you, you know, in my laboratory, we have identified a virus that's going to circulate through the entire nation. We think it will cause probably 40, 50,000 deaths and hundreds of thousands of hospitalizations. I think there would have been panic over a message like that. People would be beating down the walls of doctors' offices to get a vaccine to protect them against that. But they just seemingly cannot get into their minds that influenza is a pathogen that can kill people and hospitalize and cause complications. It's not just a minor illness. So all good reasons to, if you have not been immunized, and most of the country hasn't, as of last week, the estimate was that only about a third of us have gotten vaccine. And that's going to translate to some very sad stories of people missing work that can't afford to, or missing school, or ending up in the hospital, or in the worst case, as we've seen, with some 27 children now in the U.S. that have died as a result of this flu.
Doctor, I want to just go back to one thing you said a little earlier about how people say, well, it's just the flu.
Yeah.
And we hear a lot about cold and flu season, like they're the same thing. Could you tell us just a little bit about the differences between the two germs we're talking about here?
And that's a great question, because this year there are really four major problems occurring simultaneously, which is causing a lot of confusion and hasn't been well reported on. Let me take the easiest one first. We're having norovirus outbreaks. These are what people kind of call the cruise ship outbreaks. This is a virus that causes sudden vomiting and diarrhea, lasts a day or two, and then tends to go away. So that is not a respiratory virus. Let's set that one aside. The three respiratory diseases that are occurring in outbreaks all over the U.S. are, number one, pertussis. That's a bacterial disease that causes a cough that can be very prolonged and which can kill young infants and children. So there is the recommendation that if you've not had what's called a Tdap, tetanus, diphtheria, acellular pertussis booster, you should get one of those. The next disease is a virus called rhinovirus. That's kind of the common cold virus. and about 20% or so of the people that we test have that rhinovirus. And then, of course, influenza virus, and about 35 or more percent of people we test are infected with influenza. So you can see that people could have one or more of any of those. Pertussis typically causes a low-grade fever, sore throat, and then coughing, including coughing at night. The old-time doctors used to call it the 100-day cough, and that's a great description of it. Rhinovirus tends to cause very low-grade, if any, fever, stuffy nose, maybe a little bit of a scratchy throat, runny eyes. Influenza causes sudden fever that's usually pretty high, sore throat and cough, and really profound muscle and joint aches and fatigue. As we say, it tends to drive you to bed, you feel so badly. What influenza doesn't cause is diarrhea and vomiting. There can be some exceptions in very young children, but that's one of the ways we separate these.
Dr. Gregory Poland is a professor of medicine and infectious diseases and founder and director of the Mayo Clinic's Vaccine Research Group at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Whether it's the flu or any other pathogen, tracking an epidemic usually comes down to math. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president at Mount Holyoke College. With flu season well underway, health professionals are on the lookout for any sign of an epidemic. And as Thomas House, research fellow at the University of Warwick Mathematics Institute, explains, to fully understand an epidemic, you need to know what happens to the patients doctors never see.
One of the biggest problems when faced with an outbreak of an infectious disease is knowing how bad the consequences of the epidemic are going to be. At first, we see the number of known infectious cases growing, but eventually enough people have experienced infection that what is known as herd immunity becomes important and the number of cases declines. When we know that some cases are not detected, this makes it particularly difficult to predict the overall severity of the outbreak. In a city of 1 million people, if 10,000 have reported illness to their doctor, does that mean that only 1% have experienced infection? Or could it be that 10% have experienced infection and 9 in 10 cases are not ill enough to report anything? The people who report infection are the tip of the iceberg, and we need ways to see under the water. One way to do this is to perform lab tests on a representative sample of the population, which was done during the swine flu pandemic, showing that most cases were missed. This approach obviously involves a certain amount of cost, but our team realised that the way in which infectious diseases spread, together with data that are routinely collected from households early in any pandemic, could be used to obtain information on cases missed without extra cost and as a complement to lab testing. If one person brings infection into a household, there is a good chance that they will be the only case. But if they infect one other household member, then further secondary infections are likely. This leads to a distinctive pattern of disease in households, one which allowed us to estimate how many cases were missed. In our case, this turned out to be over half. In this way, mathematics acted like a microscope, letting us exploit the patterns of transmission the swine flu virus left during its journey through the population.
That was Thomas House of the University of Warwick. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.